next week we will not have a good one, not any nice center, but your one is going to speak here. They will be sent out here.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hi, Luca.
Hi, sorry.
Okay, we'll start in 1 minute, okay?
Okay.
Hello? Okay, so Jorge is in Uruguay, so he asked me to chair this session. Today, the speaker is Victor Tavares, and his topic is corrections to the Friedman equations from LQG. There seems to be some echo. No, okay. So Victor, can you start now?
Okay. First, I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak. As I said, my talk's going to be on some work that I've done finding corrections to the Friedman equations induced by loop quantum gravity. This is some work that was done a while back in the mu naught, in the so-called mu naught framework, and just recently redone in the mu bar framework. And this talk will be a summary of that work. Okay, so next slide, please. So our main motivation is to find the leading quantum corrections to the classical Friedman equations at late times. And so the situation we have is that in quantum theory, we work with an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, and what we wish to know is if we can find a finite-dimensional submanifold isomorphic to the classical phase space on which we can approximate the full quantum dynamics by effective equations. And since our model is written in the Hamiltonian framework, effective action methods are unsuitable, but fortunately there's this geometric quantum mechanics framework that we can use to obtain these effective equations. So our main motivation is that numerical work has been done in the full quantum theory, and by full quantum theory here I mean loop quantum cosmology, and we wish to check if the states evolved in the numerical work do remain sharply peaked and follow the trajectories given by these effective equations. Okay, so next slide. So here's a brief outline of the talk. First, I'll go over the classical theory and just briefly review the cosmological model that we're working with. Then I'll review this framework for effective theories that we have and that we use to obtain these effective equations. And then I'll go over into the quantum theory, tell you what state we're using to calculate these effective equations. And then some necessary restrictions that we need to take. And then I will explain how these effective equations are found. And then I will summarize. So next slide, please. So in the classical theory, we have the Hamiltonian constraint given by this expression here on the first line. Because of homogeneity and isotropy, the connection and triad have one independent component each. The connection is given by C, the component of the triad P. And since we're going to work at late times here, I've just written this in the regime where P is positive. For simplicity, we'll restrict ourselves to the spatially flat case. So here, K is equal to zero. Kappa is 8 pi times Newton's constant. Gamma is a Barbero-Immerti parameter. And for this talk, we'll restrict ourselves to just a free scalar field. So in this we have this kinetic term on the right side of this the Hamiltonian constraints, but there's no potential term. Okay, so for convenience, Instead of working with the canonical pair C and P, we switch instead to the canonical pair given by the volume, which is equal to P to the 3/2, and its conjugate momentum, which I denote beta. It's C up on P to the 1/2. And this isn't necessary, but it's just convenient because this simplifies many of the calculations in the quantum theory. So this is a choice we make just to simplify calculations. And if you want to get a feel for these variables, I just have how they're related here to the old geometrical dynamical variables. The volume's a scale factor cubed, and beta is gamma A dot up on A. So in these variables, the Hamiltonian constraint takes this form, which I've labeled equation 1 here. And the symplectic structure and the Poisson bracket on the phase space are given by the two expressions at the bottom here, equations 2 and 3. So this is the model we consider. So next slide, please. And as we all know, to get the equations of motion, just recall that for any function of the canonical variables, its time dependence is given by the Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian. So we just saw what the Poisson brackets were. So we can go ahead and calculate the equations of motion for this model, which I have summarized here. The first pair of equations are just the standard Friedmann equations written in the beta and V variables. If you want, you can go and use the relations in terms of the old geometrical dynamical variables just to confirm this. The second pair of equations are just the equations of motion for a free scalar field. So this is the model that we have. These are the equations of motion. These are the equations of motion for the model, and it is to these equations and to the Hamiltonian constraint that we wish to find corrections to due to quantum geometry. So next slide, please.
Is there some conversation in the back, or are there questions? So if there are no questions, then Victor will continue.
Okay, so next slide, please. We're on the slide called Framework for Effective Theories. So just to illustrate the ideas behind the framework, here I have an example of just a particle on a real line moving under a potential. And so...
Can you hear me?
Yes?
We're having terrible trouble hearing you. There's a lot of echo on the line.
Yeah, we're getting an echo also.
Okay, thank you.
Please switch off any extra mics that you may have. That is usually what causes the echo. Yeah, it seems to have gone away. Thank you very much. Victor, can you continue?
Okay, so we should be on the slide titled Framework for Effective Theories. So just to illustrate the ideas behind this framework for effective theories that we use in calculating effective equations, here I just, for simplicity, I consider just a particle moving on the real line under a potential, just to illustrate the ideas behind the framework. So in quantum mechanics, showing that quantum mechanics has a correct semi-classical limit usually involves an argument based on Ehrenfest theorem, which I've written here, labeled equation 8. The problem is that this is true for all states, not just semi-classical ones. So what we would like is something like equation 9. In other words, what we would like is to find semi-classical states such that their expectation values approximately obey the classical equations of motion. So in going from equation 8 to equation 9, basically what one has done is pull this derivative outside of the expectation value on the right-hand side. But what we would like is something even stronger than this. We would like to know if we can find semi-classical states that whose expectation values solve the classical equations of motion. But not only that, we want to know if we can incorporate the corrections to the right-hand side of equation 9 in terms of a corrected potential. In other words, we want to find semi-classical states that obey that satisfy the classical equations of motion with quantum corrections, and it is these quantum corrections that we wanna find. And so the statement is that the so-called geometric formulation of quantum mechanics gives us a framework in which we can answer this. And I'll review this in the next few slides.
Is there still an echo?
Not anymore, thank you.
Okay,
so next slide, please. Okay, so in this geometric formulation of quantum mechanics, I have two references listed at the bottom. So my discussion is based on these references. So in this framework, the quantum phase space is naturally viewed as a fiber bundle over the classical phase space. And this is what I've tried to depict in this picture on the left-hand side here.
What is quantum phase space?
The quantum phase space is a Hilbert space. And so this is what I've tried to depict here in this picture on the left-hand side. This box is supposed to represent this quantum phase space, and this blue submanifold down here is supposed to represent the classical phase space. And the projection map for this bundle is just the taking of expectation values of the operators corresponding to the canonical variables. So for any element of element of the quantum phase space, I could take these expectation values, and it projects me down to a point in the classical phase space. So it's in this sense that we can view the quantum phase space as a fiber bundle over the classical phase space. So next slide, please. So in this geometric framework, the quantum phase space comes with an inner product, and it can be described as a symplectic space via this inner product. On the second line in the right-hand box here, I have the inner product, and it naturally decomposes into real and imaginary parts. The real part defined in a Riemannian metric on this quantum phase space. The imaginary part defined in a symplectic form. So this quantum phase space can be made into a symplectic form via its inner product, and because of the fiber bundle structure, all elements of the Hilbert space with the same expectation values are on the same fiber because they all project down to the same point in the classical phase space. So vertical vectors here are those with components in the directions in which the expectation values don't change. And because we have this symplectic form, omega gives us the notion of horizontal vectors. We say two vectors are orthogonal if they're orthogonal with respect to the symplectic product. So omega gives us the notion of horizontal vectors, which we use to construct horizontal sections. So when I say we're looking for a horizontal section of the quantum phase space, it's in this sense that I'm using the word horizontal. So next slide, please. So because of the fiber bundle structure, any horizontal section can be identified with the classical phase space. So there are many possible horizontal sections that one can find. Now, when we consider dynamics, we can look for a preferred horizontal section that's preserved by the flow generated by the Hamiltonian. And this geometric framework tells us that if we can find such a section, then the quantum dynamics on such a section can be expressed in terms of an effective Hamiltonian, which is simply the expectation value of the quantum Hamiltonian operator. When we calculate this expectation value, it indeed yields the classical term as the leading term, but it also has additional terms which are quantum corrections to the classical expression. And so the statement is that This can be shown, for example, for the harmonic oscillator, this can be shown exactly. In that case, one can indeed find an exact horizontal section. The statement for Friedman is that this can be done approximately with dust. These two cases can be found worked out in Josh Willis's thesis, which I have referenced here. And the main result of this talk is that this can also be done approximately for a Friedman universe with a free scalar field. So this is probably a good point to pause and ask if there are any questions so far. Okay, if there are no questions, then we'll proceed. So next slide, please. So in this framework, the effective Hamiltonian is calculated by taking the expectation value of the Hamiltonian constraint operator. So I'm to tell you in what state to evaluate this expectation value. So because we're looking at a late time large volume approximation, it's natural to choose a semi-classical state. And nice candidates are these Gaussian coherent states. So here on the second bullet, I have a Gaussian coherent state written out. So this is a state that's peaked at some classical values of the canonical variables beta prime, v prime, phi prime, and p phi prime. And it's written in this form. Here, I'm to tell you what some of these parameters are. Epsilon is the width in the gravitational part of the state. Delta is the area gap, so it's the smallest non-zero value of the area operator. Here, lowercase v and v prime are eigenvalues of the volume operator, whose action I have expressed here in the third bullet. The volume operator just acts on these kets, brings out the label, and this has an overall multiplicative factor that goes as Planck length cubed. And on the right part of the state, there's this part that has the dependence on the scalar field, and it's a Gaussian state peaked at the value p phi prime of the scalar field momentum. Here, epsilon phi is the spread in the state. So this is the state we choose, and this is the state in which we calculate all our expectation values. So now, an important point here is that the spread epsilon in the state has to be a function of the phase space points. It cannot be left as a constant, and I'll explain this more on the next slide. So next slide, please. Delta is the area gap, so it's the smallest non-zero value of the non-zero eigenvalue of the area operator.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? Okay, so we should be on the slide called aside on epsilon. Okay, so epsilon cannot be left as a constant. It has to be chosen as a function of the phase space point. In other words, these primes variables. And the reason is because we want the relative spreads in the volume and beta to be small. However, at late times, the volumes go to infinity and beta is going to zero. So the relative spreads in the volume can be going to zero, but the relative spread in beta can be divergent. But actually, the spread delta V and delta beta both depend on epsilon. So we can't leave epsilon as a constant, but we need to choose it as a function of the phase space point in a precise way in order for the relative spreads delta V up on V and delta beta up on beta to remain small. Because we want not only do we want our state to be peaked at some classical values of the canonical variables, but we also want it to be sharply peaked, and we'll see this more clearly in a few slides. But this is an important point. Epsilon has to be chosen as a function of the phase space point in order for its psi to remain sharply peaked. So next slide. Next slide, please. Okay, so we're to confirm that our candidate semi-classical state is indeed sharply peaked. So we need to calculate the expectation values of the operators corresponding to the canonical variables. The operators corresponding to V, P phi, and phi are straightforward, but remember that in quantum cosmology, there exists no operator C corresponding to the connection, and hence by extension, beta hat also, because remember, beta was defined to be C up on root P. So just to confirm that psi is indeed sharply peaked on some value of beta prime, we need to construct an approximate operator for beta prime. So our point of departure is the expression on the first line on the right-hand side, where beta is approximately 1 up on root 1 up on I root delta times this combination of exponentials. So this is our point of departure in the classical theory. We carry this over to the quantum theory by putting hats on this expression and just taking this as our definition for beta, because on the second line we have beta hat is 1 up on I root delta times this combination of holonomy operators, which we know do exist in the quantum theory. Now, one must say that for the first line to even be approximate, we need to restrict ourselves to the regime in which root delta beta is much smaller than 1. So we take this restriction and look at just this portion of the phase space. And here, delta is, as I said earlier, it's the area gap, so it's the smallest non-zero eigenvalue of the area operator. So strictly speaking, beta hat here on the second line should have a subscript delta because it depends on this delta. But just for simplicity of notation, I just suppress this label delta. And whenever I write beta hat, I actually mean the expression on the right hand side in terms of holonomy operators. So this is the approximate beta hat operator that we use. Its action is given on the third bullet here. Its action on the cats just gives 1 up on I root delta, and the holonomy operators just shift the volume label on the cats. The other operators are just straightforward, volume max by multiplication, and so that takes care of the gravitational sector. The scalar field is just quantized in the usual way, P phi x by multiplication and phi x by differentiation. So next slide, please. So because we're working at late times, we need to input this approximation into our state and into our equations. And so what we do is we take restrictions on the parameters appearing in the state and in our equations. So these are physically motivated restrictions. So I'll just briefly go over what these are. So here, the first pair of restrictions is just essentially requiring that we're working at late times and large volumes. The first one is that V prime is much bigger than 1. That just corresponds to a large volume. The second one is this approximation that we needed for this beta hat operator to be a good operator. It's that root delta beta prime is much less than 1. And these two just correspond to late times and large volumes. The second pair of restrictions looks kind of funny. Here I have that V prime epsilon is much greater than 1. And that epsilon is much smaller than root delta beta prime, which is already being required to be much less than 1. So these two conditions look kind of funny, but with a little bit of manipulation, one can show that they're equivalent to the two on the right-hand side. These are the necessary conditions on epsilon, These are the conditions epsilon needs to satisfy in order for the state to be sharply peaked in V and in beta. So so two slides ago when I said that epsilon had to be chosen as a function of the phase space point in a certain, in a precise way, these are the conditions that one needs to satisfy. And there is a choice for epsilon such that we can satisfy both of these simultaneously. Okay? So the last pair of conditions is requiring that the scalar field be much greater than the width of the state, and that the scalar field momentum times the width is much greater than 1. If you look on the right-hand side, these just correspond, requiring that the state also be sharply peaked in phi and p phi. So these are conditions we need to take in order to ensure that our late time approximation is implemented, and also for the state psi to indeed be sharply peaked on these classical values of the canonical variables. So next slide, please. Okay, so one can go ahead. We have our state. We have these operators, and we have these restrictions on all these parameters. With these three ingredients, one can go ahead and calculate the expectation values of theta, of V and phi and P phi, and indeed show that psi is peaked at these prime values. The equations two, three, and four are pretty straightforward. They just tell me that expectation value of V is V prime, expectation value of phi is phi prime, expectation value of P phi is P phi prime. The one that looks kind of funny is the first one. Expectation value of beta is given by this expression here. So it's not directly clear that this is actually peaked on beta prime. But remember that one of our conditions was that root delta beta prime is much smaller than 1. So we can use the small angle approximation here for sine. And epsilon is being required to be small. So this whole thing on the right-hand side is actually approximately equal to beta prime in the regime in which we're working in. Similarly, one can go and calculate expectation values of the squares of these operators, which we need to... In order to calculate their spreads and confirm that psi, and one can go ahead and do this and confirm that psi does indeed saturate the Heisenberg uncertainty bound, as it should for a Gaussian coherent state. So I just have that summarized here in the last two lines. So next slide, please. So if you recall in the framework for effective theories, the effective Hamiltonian constraint is given by taking the expectation value of the quantum Hamiltonian operator. So we have our state, so we need to go and calculate this expectation value in order to get our effective Hamiltonian. And this is what I have written here and labeled equation 11. So here on the first line, I have on the first line of this equation is the gravitational Hamiltonian. And here, because of the way in which we've calculated this, it has this dependence on the spread epsilon of this state. But if we were to take epsilon really, really small, then one can show that this does indeed reduce to the gravitational Hamiltonian. That's, for example, in these APS papers by Ashtekar, Pulaski, and Singh on these mu bar dynamics. And on the second line, we have the scalar field Hamiltonian. We have our usual P phi prime squared up on 2 times the volume term. But now there's also this correction term because of the finite width of this state that comes in as 1 up on 2 epsilon phi squared. And because of these restrictions that we took, this term is actually much smaller than the lead-in term. So it's a small correction to the classical expression. And over here on the right-hand side in the square brackets, I suppressed these well-known inverse volume corrections to the inverse volume. But now there are additional terms that also depend on epsilon. But I've just suppressed them here. So let me summarize how this was calculated. We have this Gaussian coherent space psi, which satisfies some restrictions. In this state, we compute the expectation value of the Hamiltonian constraints. There are several summations and integrals to be carried out. We can do all of them except one. We're left with a very slowly convergent summation over volume. But I want to clarify that this is an exact expression for the effective for the expectation value of the Hamiltonian constraint. But it's a very slowly convergent summation, so it's not at all clear at first glance what the lead-in and what the lead-in order behavior is. So just as an approximation and evaluating this summation, what we do is we do a Poisson resummation, and we rewrite this summation in terms of a different sum that converges much more rapidly. And indeed, it converges fast enough that it's just good enough to take the first and usually the lead-in and sub-lead-in terms to get what the physics is. And so this is what we do. But I just want to clarify that this expectation value is not an asymptotic expansion, but it's we're just approximating it by an asymptotic expansion just to get what the lead-in and sub-lead-in behavior is in our late-time approximation.
So what is that historic convergence? Where is the summation over V?
I do not have the summation over V written on this slide, but when I'm evaluating the Hamiltonian constraint operator, it's an expression involving a very slowly convergent summation over V, and it's this that we're approximating by an asymptotic expansion of the resummed series. So next slide, please. So we have an expression for the effective Hamiltonian constraints. One can go and also do the same for the equations of motion. Recall that the time dependence for an operator is given by its commutator with the Hamiltonian divided by h bar. So we can go ahead and compute these commutators and evaluate and take their expectation values in the state to get the full quantum equations. The calculations proceed similarly to that of the expectation value of the Hamiltonian constraint, but I don't have them written here, but we end up with slowly convergent summations over volume, and then we resum these series and write them as an asymptotic series. So we have these expressions for the Hamiltonian constraint and for the equations of motion. To lead in and sub-lead in order, but now recall that in this effective framework, the coordinates on the phase space are the expectation values. So we take these asymptotic expansions and we write them in terms of these expectations, which for notation, I've defined as these barred variables here at the bottom. So to summarize, we compute the equations of motion and then re-express them in terms of these bar variables to obtain the effective equations on this horizontal section that we're looking for. So next slide, please. So here on this slide, I have summarized these equations. So let me just restate what I've done. For the first equations, the effective Hamiltonian constraint, this was evaluated by taking the expectation value of the quantum Hamiltonian operator, and then pulling it and then writing it back in these barred variables, which are just the expectation values. The equations of motion, the next four equations, were calculated by taking expectation values of the operators corresponding to the canonical variables commuted with the Hamiltonian divided by IH bar, and this is what one gets. So I just want to restate that these are the exact quantum equations to lead in and sublead in order. Here, the terms in red are just the classical expressions. So the terms in red are just the classical expressions which we saw on the fourth slide of my talk. And everything in black is a quantum correction to the classical expressions. So if we just look at the Hamiltonian constraint for a second, we see that the classical expression gets modified by this term in parentheses that's 1 minus 1/4 delta beta squared. And remember, delta is the area gap, which has a factor of Planck length squared in it. And the Planck length squared is GH bar. So this is indeed a quantum correction. And remember that root delta beta is a small parameter, so delta beta squared is even smaller. So this is indeed a small quantum correction to the classical expression. The last term on the first line is a term that depends on epsilon because of this coherent state that we're using that has a finite width. This term isn't here classically. The second line is just the scalar field Hamiltonian. And we have the classical expression here with these inverse volume corrections, which I've suppressed, because when we look at the first Friedmann equations in a few minutes, what's important is the corrections to the gravitational part of the Hamiltonian constraint on the first line. Okay? So the equation 13 is just a modification of the beta dot equation. The terms in red, once again, are just the classical expressions. Everything in black is a quantum correction. We pick up this factor that goes as a square root of 1 minus 1/4 delta beta squared. And there's this term that goes as a delta beta to the fourth, which is a small quantum correction to the classical term. And on the next line, the scalar field part of this equation gets modified similarly. The V dot equation is just the classical equation, 3 beta up on gamma V prime times this square root factor. And the last two equations, the scalar field equations, are the least modified. Phi dot just picks up these inverse volume corrections. And P phi continues to remain a constant of the motion even with these corrected correction terms. So I just want to restate that this is the effective Hamiltonian constraint that was calculated by evaluating the expectation value of the Hamiltonian constraint operator and then writing it in terms of the coordinates on this horizontal section. And the equations of motion were evaluated by taking the expectation value of the exact quantum equations. Okay? So as a consistency check, what one can do is go to the next slide, please. What one can do is pull back the symplectic form to these barred variables, and we have this expression that I have here on the first line. Now we have this correction term that's in red. As a consistency check to these effective equations that we found, we can take this effective Hamiltonian constraint. Modified symplectic form, and it's associated Poisson bracket that I have on the second line here, and we can indeed see we can start with this effective Hamiltonian and this modified Poisson bracket, and indeed check to see if this effective Hamiltonian does indeed generate those equations of motion that I had on the previous slide, and the statement is yes. We can go ahead and show that the effective Hamiltonian does indeed generate those equations of motion with this modified symplectic form. So this is a very good consistency check on our effective equations. Another check one can do is what I have described here on the slide. Recall that these bar variables are the coordinates on the horizontal section, which I've labeled gamma, and we wish to know whether gamma is preserved by the flow generated by this Hamiltonian. And so what one can check is whether this the vector of the these barred variables with dots over them, we can check whether this vector is tangent to gamma or not. And if it's tangent to gamma, then gamma is indeed preserved by the flow generated by this effective Hamiltonian. But if it's not, then we want to know whether the components of this vector off of gamma are small in a controlled way. And the statement is that in this model, we do not have an exact horizontal section gamma, but the components of this vector off of gamma are very small to within our order of approximation. So it's in this sense that we claim that we found an approximately horizontal section gamma of the quantum phase space. So this is a second consistency check on these effective equations that we have. And it is indeed true that we have an approximately horizontal section of the quantum phase space, where the dynamics is generated by this effective Hamiltonian constraint. So next slide, please. So we're used to working with the first Friedmann equation in standard form. So what one can do is re-express the equations of motion that I had two slides ago, and write them as the first Friedmann equation. So we know the Hubble parameter is a dot upon h, so we can calculate what h squared is and see what these effective equations tell us. And one can go ahead and do that to within our order of working consistently to within our order of approximation, and indeed show that one does recover the classical expression kappa rho upon 3. Rho is the density. But now there's this correction term that goes as rho squared, and it comes in with a minus sign. This is what I have here in red. The correction is minus rho upon rho crit. Rho crit is this combination of factors here, which one can show is approximately about 4/5 the Planck density. So this correction term is very small up until we reach Planckian densities. But this is an effective Friedmann equation that one gets. And it's surprising because even though we're doing a late-time large volume approximation, the numerical work done in loop quantum cosmology has shown that these effective equations hold in a regime, even very close up to small volumes. So, like, we expect them to only hold at late times, but they continue to hold even beyond that. And before I proceed here, I should say that on the right-hand side of equation 17, there are additional terms that depend on epsilon because we're using this coherent state that has a finite width. But these terms are much smaller than the terms shown here, so I've suppressed them on this slide. So next slide, please. So now I'll just summarize what was done. So we found an approximately horizontal section of the quantum phase space where the full quantum dynamics can be approximated by effective differential equations. Remember, the quantum phase space is infinite dimensional, but we're able to approximate the full quantum dynamics on this finite dimensional submanifold in terms of these effective differential equations at late times. So that is, we found corrections to the Friedmann equations, which can be described as being generated by an effective Hamiltonian constraint. which is just the expectation value of the Hamiltonian constraint operator. And also we've shown that these effective equations are self-consistent to within our order of approximation and include the lead-in corrections due to quantum geometry. And surprisingly, even though our approximation was intended for just late times, numerical results show that these effective equations continue to hold well beyond where we thought they would hold. So that's my talk. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Victor. We have time for questions, comments. Yes, please.
Actually, I have a question. I have a confusion about the approximation rate of the calculation.
Okay.
So, we assume that the square root delta times beta is much smaller than 1.
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe like I'm just adding to the confusion or to the miracle which you were pointing out. So, since you are assuming that you are at low space-time curvature,
Yes.
So then how can one get an equation which describes high space time curvature?
So our goal wasn't to describe to obtain an equation describing the what's happening at high curvature. Our goal was less ambitious. It was just to find the lead-in quantum corrections to the Friedman equations at late times. It's just surprising that these equations continue to be a good description, even in this regime. So this isn't a claim that we're making it, but it's just.
That's what I agree, but I want to go to a detail of the calculation.
Okay.
I'm not sure because actually, what was originally done. So is it like that? One really assumes that square root of delta beta is much smaller than one, or one has done the calculation
for C
variables and then went to beta.
No, I did this in the beta variables and with this restriction that you just said.
But you see, like, if we assume square root of, if we assume a similar condition for the connection, then it is still understandable. So the connection is not a space-time curvature. And you can, for the massless scalar, you can have conditions where if you are going backward in the universe, your connection remains small, and your space-time curvature becomes large. That is how the contracting or the backward expansion shows. So, like, now I'm more confused about why this equation works.
So, what is the confusion? You seem to feel that it is, you don't have confusion if you work in C and P, but you have confusion if you work in beta and V. But it's the same condition, so I'm not understanding what you're...
So there is a difference. So suppose if one is working in C and P, and one derives this exactly this low critical, not the whole mu naught one.
Okay.
And then one assumes the condition on epsilon c being less than one. That is different from assuming epsilon beta being less than one.
But epsilon is say same as square root of delta or what?
Yeah, okay. Like, I think it is not
from the
same, I agree.
Yeah. So let me just say the following, okay? That a priori, one might not have expected these equations to hold anywhere near the bounds. Okay. However, supposing Victor actually has these equations, and he chooses the parameters like P phi to be sufficiently large, you know, sort of a million or billion in H, billion times H bar or something, and he just finds a solution to his semi-classical equations. Now, internally, one could say that he should not trust his solution if, in fact, the solution enters a regime in which his assumptions are violated. But if he had chosen P phi to be sufficiently large, then even at the bounds point, his assumptions are not violated. And therefore, even without knowing the numerical simulation, Victor could conclude that his equations give you a consistent solution. They should be valid even at the bounds, provided the parameters of the state were chosen to be sufficiently large. That is to say, P5 is sufficiently large. Would you agree with this?
I need some more clarification, and I hope it is true. The point is that the thing is that beta is like V naught over A, always. Okay?
Okay.
So I would like to see like that as a base thing, take P5 very large, and even if you are at that makes sufficient that the delta beta being less than being much smaller than 1 is always satisfied. Which is a counterintuitive thing for me is that once it's translating eta with the space-time curvature and the energy density also with the space-time curvature, it's very intermingled, so it's not very clear to me.
Okay. So my suggestion is that we just look at the solution just in terms of beta and V and see if these conditions are satisfied. If the solution enters a regime in which these conditions are violated, you cannot trust them. You cannot trust these solutions, but if the solution obeys these conditions all throughout the history, then there is a consistent solution. There may be something still wrong for a certain reason, but at least it's a consistent solution. That's what
I'm saying. I agree.
Okay. Martin, do you have any comments?
Maybe just a few clarifications, which is actually something that Victor mentioned, but maybe not in detail, especially about the last point. It's not just large volume that's important, but also just short-term evolution, because if you look at long-term evolution, it might happen that all these parameters like epsilon and also other parameters about the state that were not included grow and also enhance these correction terms. So in particular, if one starts with a semi-classical state at large volume and then evolves to small volume, which requires usually long evolution times, then the state itself might not be semi-classical anymore at this point. And that would also imply that the equations, even though they would show this Rochefort behavior for a semi-classical state, would not exactly apply there. So in this case, one would have to do a more precise analysis and see how these state parameters, such as epsilon, are actually evolving, derived equations of motion for them, which would mean to go to, in a sense, higher orders in this effective equation scheme, and then see what's happening to them. So that can also be done self-consistently. But I think that's the main reason why all these conclusions about the bounds from this type of effective equations are to be taken more carefully, as Victor mentioned. So that's just one more clarification that I wanted to make here.
Okay. But Martin, I mean, I agree with you, but on the other hand, Victor has an explicit formula for epsilon in terms of V, and he has a formula for V dot. So to get the equation for epsilon is relatively straightforward, and you should do it, but there's nothing deep about it. I'm just trying to understand your point.
Yeah, well, I think there was an assumption involved about epsilon, which was basically a guess of what kind of horizontal section one can take or whether there's a horizontal section at all. And I think that has to be self-consistently checked, and which one can do by these equations of motion for epsilon that I mentioned. I just think at the current stage in this framework it hasn't been done, but I'm not saying it would not be done.
But do you agree that since he has a formula for epsilon, just to see that Victor is not missing something, since he has a formula for epsilon in terms of V and beta, and he has formula for beta dot, he could just plug in and get a formula for epsilon dot.
Yeah, but I don't see how that this equation for epsilon in terms of V was derived.
Okay.
That's the point here. So, but it can be done. So it's just one step that I think is missing.
Okay.
Okay. Any other comments or questions?
Yes.
There's a question here from Alex. Alex, please come up and speak up in the speakerphone.
The question is whether you have any control about the horizontal sections if you change the labs, for instance. I understand you just choose labs to be one, but what happens if you don't choose dynamic labs? Is there any change in the horizontal sections?
At the moment, I can't say because we haven't analyzed what would happen if we were to choose a different labs. So here, as you said, we have labs equal to 1. So I wouldn't be able to say what would happen in that case.
Actually, I have one more question.
Okay.
So what happens for the case of that? Like, do you get the same form of the Friedman equation?
I think so. I think this was redone at some point in the mu bar framework, but the reference I gave, the calculation that Josh did was just completely in the mu zero framework. But
so in the mu zero framework, like, I know the answer. It's the same.
Okay.
Okay, and you can also add up a small little constant and still do the analysis. Is it true?
No, there's some technical issues that still need to be worked out in the cosmological constant case. So we haven't looked at that yet.
The reason why Josh stopped with the cosmological constant case was because he was doing with the mu naught evolution. And the mu naught evolution is a problem, the standard problem that he encountered. So the question is, what happens with the mu bar?
Yeah. Thank you.
Are there any other comments or questions? If not, let us thank Victor again. Jorge, are there any announcements? I guess not. So, okay. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Sorry, I just... Oh, sorry.